Cascadia and the edge of the world, Euphemet presents Night Drift with Jim Perry.
Live on Alternative Talk, 1150 KKNW AM, and worldwide at euphemet.com. I'm Jim Perry, and you are listening to Night Drift, presented by Euphemet. Tonight, we'll revisit a conversation I had with Gary Lachman last year, an author of many books on the links between consciousness, culture, and the Western esoteric tradition. Gary has a new book we allude to called Dreaming Ahead of Time. It's about his experiences with precognitive dreams, synchronicity, and coincidence. It looks like that'll release in January, and I'm sure we'll have him back on to chat about that. Gary was also once known as Gary Valentine while playing in the band Blondie, and you'll notice we'll get into that in this conversation as well. I hope you had a great Thanksgiving this year, that you feel happy and thankful for being here right in this very minute. I'm certainly feeling very thankful today. It's been a very strange weekend, one in which I narrowly avoided tragedy. This is a story for another time. I'll actually probably tell it next week on the show. But for now, let's go directly to my conversation with Gary Lachman, here on Night Drift with Jim Perry, on Alternative Talk, KKNW, 1150 AM. Well, I read recently on your Facebook timeline that you had a dream in 1998 in which a message was imparted to you that echoes today's situation in sort of a stunning way. Can you describe this experience?
What I'm currently working on is a book about precognitive dreams. And these are dreams in which little bits and pieces of the future, sometimes it's more dramatic, you've got little bits of the future in your dreams, and it's a strange thing. It's something I've been recording in my dreams for quite some time now. But I've been going through old journals of mine, and I went through a batch from sort of the mid 80s up into kind of the mid 90s. And there was one from 1989 that someone in the dream is saying to me, stay at home. There's no reason to go out. Just stay at home where it's safe. More or less that. And then I just thought, how strange, you know. I'm not saying that particular dream from 1989 was precognitive in the sense that I knew this was going to happen. But I would put it in the realm of, very odd coincidence sliding over into what Jung called synchronicities, which are coincidences that have some kind of meaning behind them. Something along those lines, because I mean that's the message that we've been hearing for at least until recently, which changed to stay alert, which I think go ahead. Good luck with that one,
right?
Because everyone should be staying alert in the first place, but stay at home is something you should.
Yeah.
In any case, wow. So this was the thing. I thought, oh, how strange, I jotted down things like that the last 40 years, more or less. And so I'm trying to, what I'm working on now is just sort of finally writing about them.
Yeah. So just yesterday, in terms of possible synchronicities, my mother-in-law had a precognitive dream that she shared that was fairly stunning and provocative in terms of the future of my wife and I's housing situation, perhaps.
Right.
And I stumbled upon that and this quest, this writing that you're imparting now with precognitive dreaming and you revealing that it's something that you've been interested in or affected by for a very long time. You're, I assume right now, in the muck of it, in the process of writing. What about this is really propelling you into this direction currently?
To tell you the truth, I don't like talking about work in progress that much, but I'll just say a bit. What happened was that I gave a talk last year at Brompton Cemetery, which is this wonderful cemetery in west side of London. And there was a group that organizes talks at interesting locations. So it was in a chapel in the cemetery, and it was part of something they called the London Month of the Dead. So it's rather romantic kind of thing, gothic. And so I gave a talk on hypnagogia and precognitive dreams. And hypnagogia is a sort of umbrella term for a variety of different sort of dreams or hallucinations or visions or even auditory phenomena where you hear voices that happen in this brief state called the hypnagogic state. That's between when we're falling asleep. You know, we're still awake, but we're on our way to fall asleep. So it's in between waking and sleeping. And likewise in the morning, although some scholars slice it very fine here. And they call it hypnopompic. So in the one you're going down into sleep, the other one you're rising up out of sleep. But in any case, there are these sorts of half dreams and visions, and people see faces or they hear, you know, sentences, things of that sort. And there's a wonderful book that's just called Hypnagogia that came out in the late 80s by a fellow named Andreas Mavromatis, where he maps it all out. It's the most exhaustive study. And I had written about that as a phenomenon itself. I did an article about it, but then also many of the people I've written about, people like Jung and Rudolf Steiner, and Swedenborg, and Uspensky and others, they all were very good hypnagogues in the sense that they all talked about, wrote about their own experiences in that realm. And I've had some myself, and it's actually quite fascinating, you know. And I mean, I've been interested in my dreams for a long time. That's what I say in the current thing I'm writing about, how this interest goes back to about 1980. So at this talk, I figured, oh, well, if I'm going to talk about hypnagogia, let me just talk a bit about precognitive dreams, just to sort of, you know, tack on something. Because precognition is something that happens in the hypnagogic state as well. Hypnagogic state is actually the one that's most... what do you want to call it, sort of prone or most associated with a variety of different paranormal sort of phenomena, one of which is precognition, you know, telepathy as well, and clairvoyance or remote viewing, as it's called these days. And so I thought, oh, I just would tack this on. And I talked about people who wrote about it quite a bit. So the first person is a fellow named J.W. Dunn, who published a book in the 1920s called An Experiment with Time. And in that book, he discovered that he dreamt the future, and he talks about that. And then another person was J.B. Priestley, you know, who was a very well-known English writer in the last century. He's not as read that much these days. But he wrote a lot of plays having to do with time and time loops and a play called Time and the Conways and so on and so on and so on. So he's talking about that. And just at the end, I tagged on a couple dreams of my own, which I had mentioned here and there in different sort of books and footnotes, but I hadn't. Well, actually, aside from an article I wrote quite some time ago, back in 97, where I did one article about all this. I mean, I haven't really, you know, sort of specifically addressed it. So it was after that talk, what happened the next day was when I looked on Twitter, someone who was at the talk had posted a tweet, and she said, oh, my God, I was at this talk about precognitive dreams, and I did, you know, what this guy said. It was basically, I said, just write your dreams down and then, you know, pay attention, stay alert for the day. And she said, oh, my God, it's true. And what she said was that she had a dream in which she was picking a hedgehog up, which is a common animal here. I don't know if you see them too much out where you are, but and she sort of saw a hedgehog, and she picked it up out of the road and took it, you know, over to the side, the pavement, or up in the grass or something like that, so it would be safe, it wouldn't get run over. And she said the first thing she saw in her Twitter feed was a post about how to protect the hedgehogs. And so she said, oh my God, you know. And I said, yep, that's it. And it's not exactly it. It's subject to what's called symbolic distortion. So it's although many precognitive experiences can be, you know, carbon copies or pre-copies, however you call it. So when that happened, I thought, okay, you know, yeah, maybe let's see. So I just talked to one of my publishers here, and it's going to be a relatively short book too. And it's kind of a personal approach, so it's not, I'm not trying to explain it, but just sort of this is my experience of it, as it were.
Yeah, perhaps with the rule lines in the back, a couple pages for people to start in on their own dreams, yeah?
Yeah, well, sure, could do that.
Please, yeah, write them down. Very fascinating. I can't wait to hear what your interpretation of that is and dig into that book. But for now, I was curious, what was your inciting incident for the exploration of the occult?
Oh, well, it wasn't one particular thing. I mean, I've told the story a lot. It is what happened is that I just came across a very good book about it. And this was in 1975. Many moons ago, when I was living in New York on the Bowery, and in the early days of Blondie, and I was living there with Chris Stein, the guitarist, and Debbie Harry, and they themselves had a kind of pop, you know, fun interest in that sort of thing. So, you know, some pentagrams around and candles and the I Ching and things like that, and but also where we were living on the Bowery, the fellow who sort of was renting the floor to us, he was very interested in Aleister Crowley, you know, the great dark magician, or notorious dark magician of the 20th century. And he had a pack of Crowley's tarot deck, which at the time was relatively rare, and he would do these readings and he paintings based on the tarot cards. And I just started getting interested in it. I mean, I wasn't interested in the occult per se before then. I mean, it's just in the forms of, like, you know, horror fiction, H.P. Lovecraft, or horror films. I didn't really take it seriously. So, but in that context, I said, oh, this is interesting. And, you know, it was a lot of stuff left over from the previous generation, this kind of cultural debris from the late 60s. So, you know, I mentioned the I Ching, the Timothy Leary's books, and things of that sort. And I came across a copy of a book that literally changed my life. It was just called The Occult, and it was by a British writer named Colin Wilson. And it was just this fascinating history, but also exploration into it. I mean, I want to say it's philosophical, but it's a page turner, so it's not, you know, it's not heady and academic in any way, but it's very, very well read, and he's a very exciting writer in the sense that he really gets into the ideas and explores them, and he associates them with so many things. And it just wasn't a book about spells or witchcraft or things of that sort. It was a you know, readable kind of narrative history and then philosophical exploration, mostly about consciousness. And I just became fascinated with it. And I mean, I subsequently wound up writing a book about Wilson himself many, many years later after he died. But that was it. I mean, and then it was a good time for someone to get interested in that sort of thing, because in New York then there was kind of an occult boom in the publishing world. So there were lots of books and lots of cheap reprints of, you know, classic texts that were, I guess, public domain by then. And I just, you know, and there were wonderful places like the old Weiser's bookshop, which isn't there anymore.
Right.
So, so at the same time that I was first playing in Blondie and hanging out CBGBs, I was reading all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I will have introduced you in a bio segment before this as the great Gary Valentine. But offhandedly, I learned from your work that someone like Blavatsky was a teetotaler, which to me appears to perhaps be the first straight edger. And many of my listeners will know about how things like New Thought and PMA or positive mental attitude greatly influenced the New York punk scene. So, you know, my question is why is it that musicians, artists, multi-hyphenate creatives are seemingly more prone to the exploration of the occult and the supernatural?
Well, I mean, there's a long history of music and the occult, the supernatural.
You know, yeah.
Paganini, The Devil's Trill, and Tartini, and all that. And then Robert Johnson selling his soul, you know, to the devil and the crossroads. And I would say just, you know, creative pursuits and something like the occult or mystical or, you know, exploring further reaches of consciousness would be something that, not exactly the same thing, but occupying the same kind of space. as it were. I mean, and, you know, they both deal with the unconscious and the sense of inspiration in some way. I mean, music has always been a part. I mean, what you have happening now is a whole kind of self-conscious movement known as occulture, you know, very loose, but I mean, just fundamentally, you know, it's either some cultural kind of activity that's, you know, very informed by occult ideas, or an occult activity practice that is likewise, you know, culturally sophisticated, let's say. Mm. And, you know, I've spoken at quite a few sort of conferences on that, and there's lots of literature about it and things of that sort. So, I mean, there's a self-conscious kind of way of blending these two things together. So it's not only music, but it's also an art and things of that sort. But I mean, in the 60s, it was something that was very, very popular. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, 67, the Beatles had Crowley, the cover of Sgt. Pepper, and he was the hottest thing in town. And out of that time, I mean, things changed, but he kind of remained a pop icon. Crowley was there because he was, right, this, you know, the wild man, this wild man. He was this, yeah, bad boy. He was doing all the drugs and all the sex and everything like that. You know, giving the finger to society and so on. So, yeah. I mean, but, you know, if you look back at the 60s, that my first book, Turn Off Your Mind, is about the influence of occult ideas on pop culture in the 60s. I mean, other people were, you know, part of that as well, Blavatsky and others. And then they kind of lost that pop association, but Crowley kind of kept his, you know, he was still a part of it. So, yeah, I mean, there's different levels. I mean, you know, I mean, you said you're tapping into the unconscious, you know, that kind of thing. You're sort of getting the critical conscious ego out of the way and allowing deeper, you know, energies to come out, as it were, if I'm not waxing too, too mystical here.
Right. Yeah, interesting. I mean, it appears as if, you know, Crowley is a sort of an entryway into this because of the sex, the drugs, the rock and roll, yeah, the sort of the cool factor of digging into such an esoteric individual and thought leader of the occult, where you'll see a lot of folks will then go from Crowley to other books, individuals. Mm. Tuck themselves into a deeper understanding that actually starts perhaps affecting their level of consciousness to the subjects at hand. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, that can happen. I mean, it all depends on the person. I mean, I'm not claiming any particular credit, but it actually did, you know, when I say it changed my life, I mean, it did, because I eventually left music, not necessarily because of that, but, And certainly in some ways, because I was reading all this stuff, and my mind was focusing on were sorts of things that you couldn't really quite communicate in a song anymore.
Yeah.
You could sort of stretch it in a certain direction, but once you know, I mean, I'm not, in a way, I mean, I say jokingly say I was getting too smart for rock and roll, but I mean, I was a songwriter for a while. I mean, I don't have a, you know, fantastic list, but, you know, I've got a few and yeah. it just seemed to me one of the people I really liked at the time when I was playing was Tom Verlaine, who was the, you know, guitarist and wrote most of the music and sang in this band Television, who were part of the CBGB scene. And I thought what he was doing and the songs he were writing was, should we say it? To me, they were approaching the kind of level of expression of poetry, and without kind of bending and breaking the form of the pop song. Because when you try to do it, it becomes too intent, too self-conscious.
Mm.
Or on the other side, you have these epic kind of, you know, operatic sorts of things that are unlistenable after, you know, very soon after they're written. I just felt like, well, you know, I wrote some songs and I just felt like I just couldn't communicate in that way anymore.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, eventually I stopped and I the last thing I did, I just was guitarist.
Was that a hard decision to make at the time, or did it just seem natural?
I mean, different things were happening. I mean, or actually not happening, because I mean, my own band didn't get a record deal. So that was another thing. I had a band called The No, that I formed in Los Angeles after leaving Blondie. And then we were a bi-coastal band. We played LA and New York a lot. This is in from like 78 to about 80.
Yeah.
And then, but you know, after punching it out and blah, 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 we did a couple, you know, I did a 45 and then on my own, you know, and then, just sort of packed it in. And then I was asked to play on two North American tours in Iggy Pop's band. And some friends of mine were playing. Actually, Clem Burke, the drummer from Blondie, played on tour.
Wow.
So that was fun to do. But after that, that was kind of like, okay, I did my Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. And by that time, I was, you know, I was thinking, okay, I didn't want to do this anymore. And I didn't self-consciously go on a quest, but I did, you know, I was lucky enough to make some money from one of my songs, too. I didn't have to really do anything immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point in the early 80s, I went on this kind of mini search for the miraculous, as I later tended to call it, going to places like Glastonbury, Chartres Cathedral. And but on one of those things, I made a pilgrimage down to Cornwall, where Colin Wilson was living.
Yeah.
And this was after I was, you know, read many of his books and all that by that time. And so that you know, that shifted into a whole other thing, you know.
We'll be right back with Gary Lockman here on Night Drift, presented by Euphemet.
Follow Euphemet on Spotify and subscribe on iTunes to receive new episodes of Night Drift automatically and gain access to all of our past episodes. Drifting into the night, this is Jim Perry. You are listening to Night Drift, presented by Euphemet.
Well, it's interesting because I think a lot of people share this story with you, right? I mean, they find an author, a writer, a philosopher who is able to crack open their mind. And sort of crack open their heart a little bit, and you become almost a bystander to your curiosity, to your wonderment almost, right? Mm. Some of this stuff seemingly can take you over in the most astounding ways and almost lead you down a trail until you realize you're a part of it all.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been, you know, reading, I sort of started reading Collins' books, 1975. So that's, you know, do the math. That's quite some time ago. So, and obviously meeting someone for that length of time, and then you change, and then my relationship changes. And then after he died, that changed too. And then, I mean, I was determined to write a book about him. I mean, fundamentally, my book is Beyond the Robot, you know, Life and Work of Colin Wilson. It's my attempt to put all in one package, you know, his work, which is over, I mean, his career. I mean, he died in 2013 and his first book came out in 1956. So
wow.
He was around for quite some time as well. He wrote well over 150 books and on a remarkable different number of things, but all sort of focused on these central kind of existential questions of freedom and consciousness and, you know, blending into what we would call esoteric or spiritual questions about being awake and conscious and exploring different areas of yourself and sort of frontiers of psychology and so on. And, and then having written that book, it's, you know, your relationship changes. So, one of the great things about reading his books is that he's interested in lots of different things. So, he's writing about lots of other writers and authors and philosophers and so on. And if you follow up these leads, you end up getting like a liberal arts education.
Right.
It's very incredibly wide reading. And I guess I've picked up something like that. Or maybe I'm just determined to tell everybody how many books I read. But, you know, my own books, I sort of say, oh, you know, I'm kind of doing the same sort of thing in the sense of, well, here, these things kind of add up.
Yeah, right.
So kind of put them. I mean, it's not a system in any way. It's just sort of like, you know, you find different people talking about, you know, the same ideas in sort of different ways, and you line them up with some perception or angle or perspective that you're taking it from, and then you can kind of tell a story. You know, I mean, I guess that's what I like. Why I like doing biographies, because I feel like I'm sort of telling a story of ideas. So it's something along those lines.
Yeah, but
narrative philosophy.
Yeah, it personalizes it, and it shares the emotion. Mm. It shares the humanity of these individuals and where these ideas come from, and this idea that we can consume sort of these endless tomes of philosophy that feel almost medicinal in some ways. I think it detaches itself from what is inherent in a lot of this, which is the connection to the person themselves. And that's what I really enjoy about your work is getting the opportunity to actually meet the people behind these ideas. And honestly, for me, your book on Crowley was much more digestible and something I could connect with much better, even within his own philosophy, than reading his own work for myself. You know, so I think it has a way of illuminating these ideas in a positive way, and also showing them in their bare naked form that is really, really fascinating. And I can see that going about that process of writing a book of that nature and finally finding yourself writing about Colin Wilson in that way must have been an immense pleasure, but also an incredible challenge. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I mean, and I sort of set it up, you know, up front, and you know, it's no secret that he was a mentor and things of that sort. So, I mean, it wasn't going to be a sort of critical warts and all biography.
Yeah,
and I even say it's kind of a biography of ideas, and it's the sort of book he would have written about, you know, the people that he writes about. I mean, that was not a conscious aim, but it was something that was going to be like that anyway. It gave me an opportunity to repay a debt. Also, I guess to some degree, having done that, freed me some way from, you know, relationship in that way. So not, you know, it's, I mean, that's a whole learning process too, as you go along, you know, well, I guess with any sort of form of self-expression that way, you know, if you look back at earlier work and then gradually as you go on, you get your voice, it's still your voice, but it changes the perspectives a bit different, perhaps a bit more authority or something along those lines or whatever. And no, that was something I have to say, I'm very, very happy that I was able to do that book. And that's one reason was that I had pretty good editor at Penguin at the time, was Mitch Horowitz.
Mitch is great.
Commissioned quite a few of my books, going back to the Steiner book. Dark Star Rising was the last one. For many years. And I sort of convinced him that Wilson was important and he needed, I mean, he's known, but he's not known. You know, some people know of him, but they don't. So, and I'm not trying to sell him as, this lost, forgotten genius, is saying, well, you know, his works are very important, you know, and they certainly informed the way I've looked at things and introduced me to other things. And then you kind of shuffle all that around. And, you know, you get to a certain point where you can start saying, well, actually, you know, I think you're wrong about him. Going back and reading, like, you know, and, you know, so you can even, that's when you're even more free. I tell you something. It wasn't about him. It wasn't about Wilson, but this is a while ago when I was in Munich. A friend who lived there invited me there. I was there for the first time, and I brought with me a copy of this book called The Jung Cult by Richard Knoll, and I think about in the 90s or something. It's a real kind of attack on Jung as this kind of elitist, Gnostic cult leader who wants to set up a whole kind of religion around himself and so on. So, I mean, it's subsequently been sort of discredited. Yeah. And in some ways, I just felt like, well, so what? So what if he did? He's still really interesting. But the thing about it was that a lot of what was happening in what Knowles was talking about was taking place in where it was in Munich. There's an area called Schwabing, which is this sort of countercultural kind of area back then in the day. And so I was in the midst of it walking around reading the book, and I didn't care that he was critical. I felt like I could read it without having to say, without having to come and defend Jung in some way. Mm. I think when you can do that, when you can read some critical work about, someone you like, one of your heroes or whatever, you don't have to agree with it, but you can read it without cringing and immediately having to, defend. Then you have a kind of distance from it, and so I mean, this is the basic kind of critical stance, and you can't remain a student all the time. You can't remain just in that position, otherwise your teacher is a bad teacher. also in kind of in a way, I guess you can bring in something like Harold Bloom's anxiety of influence, where you there's a kind of Oedipal relationship where in a certain way you have to sort of take down the generation, your hero, whatever it is, in order for you to establish yourself. And I wouldn't say necessarily I did that with Colin, but I would say something along those lines, not self-consciously, because I subsequently just understood this is what I was doing. I wasn't trying to do it at the time. Was doing something like that in this book, Turn Off Your Mind, which is a book about the 60s, which it's critical. I mean, it's written with a kind of critical tone, sort of turning it around, saying, oh, wow, it was flower power, but actually the roots of flower power were in the dark soil of whatever, Satan, something along those lines. I mean, it's an interesting book because a later edition of it on the back cover, I say that it's acclaimed by fundamentalist Christians and Satanists alike, and because they both liked it. They both liked it. I mean, why it's not a worldwide success, I don't know. It appealed to everybody.
Right. Thank you for sharing that. What I would like to just ask you about is this new book. Mm. What can people expect once digging into The Return of Holy Russia?
A page turner.
Yeah.
A good read. What can I say? I hope people who get it understand that, the people I'm writing about, these philosophers from what's known as the Silver Age, who are getting a retread with Putin. Putin has gone back into this pre-Bolshevik time of great creativity and a kind of intense spirituality and fascination with the occult in this period called the Silver Age, just before the Bolshevik boot came down. He's dipping into that this kind of new identity that it's been looking for a while. And I hope they just get as interested and excited just in the history of Russia as I got myself. I mean, that sounds like a tough, a tall order. But what happened to me was that when the reason I got interested is that I saw an article that Putin had back in 2014 or 15, he had a reading list that he gave to his regional governors on the annual meetings of, United Russia. And on the reading list were these philosophers from this period called the Silver Age, Vladimir Solovyev, Nikolai Berdyaev, I mean, both of whom I'd read. Mm. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I mean, not too many world leaders that I know of, not that I know too many world leaders, but, they don't usually give out, intense spiritual philosophers to read. But then I saw the response from the West and people like David Brooks, the New York Times, and some other journalists, that they were characterizing these philosophers from the Silver Age as these kind of messianic pan-Russian mystical philosophers who taken up this idea of you know, somehow Russia as having this peculiar role in world history, and it was going to spread some kind of universal kind of belief or this new religion kind of thing, and which was something that was, you know, talked about in different ways in the period, the Silver Age. And that's how I start the book, talking about, you know, Rudolf Steiner giving lectures about this in Paris. And but once I started looking into that and just sort of following up the line of, okay, why is it Holy Russia? You know, there's, okay, yes, it's got to do with they're adopting the Greek Orthodox Church, Christianity, and Constantinople was the second Rome after the first Rome, and then when that fell, Moscow somehow taken on that mantle. And again, this is another kind of messianic vision. And I just started getting very interested in this kind of story, you know. And why did people like Steiner and Oswald Spengler, who's again, he's not read that much these days, the German philosopher of history, who wrote this book called Decline of the West, you know, arguing that Europe and the West was going down, but the East, you know, there was going to be a new culture arising, and Russia at the time, you know, pre-Bolshevik, was sort of in the running for that. And Hermann Hesse and other people at the time having this kind of sensibility that, you know, something was coming from that, you know, part of the world that was going to change things. And then the Bolshevik boot came down, and that spirituality and all of that was quelched. And, you know, many of those philosophers were shipped out of the country on what's known as the philosophy steamers, you know, these boats that Lenin exiled all these thinkers on, you know, because he didn't want to shoot them because the press would be too bad. But he didn't want them to stay, to stick around.
Yeah, that mirrors Hitler's own move.
I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. Well, I think often I don't know if he was as kind as putting them on boats. Well, in a different kind of mode of transport. But what do you want to say? It's a different history than the West. I think a lot of people don't know. I mean, I certainly didn't know much about Russian history. That's why I said I got excited. It just became an interesting story for me. I like learning. One of the reasons I like, you know, writing the books. I mean, I don't know all this stuff and then just sit down and decide to, you know, oh, yes, I will now, you know, I will now impart all of my knowledge about this. I mean, I have to go out and find out about it. You know, I don't know about it. I'm a quick learner, and I can turn it quickly from, you know, notes into, well, with any luck, knock on wood, you know, readable paragraphs and things of that sort. So I just was fascinating learning about all this stuff.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting things is that, you know, it seemed that at that time in the late 19th century, early 20th century, when in many ways the kinds of problems we're facing today were, you know, starting to, you know, build up this momentum in different ways. The thinkers in Russia before the Bolsheviks saw what was lacking in the Western consciousness and the Western approach, this utilitarian, you know, pragmatic, practical, materialistic, you know, what was missing, the soul, you know, to give a simple answer.
Yeah.
And this is why you have this tremendous kind of intense spirituality in people like Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, and so many, and even Gogol a little bit earlier, all these kind of people. And so there seemed to be something that this generation of the Silver Age philosophers had something to offer to the West, and then it was, you know, it was aborted. So I guess my argument is, you know, whether Putin's reading them or not, or for whatever reason he's reading them for, it seems to me that we can still learn something from them that we can apply today, because they were talking about the same kinds of problem, or the root cause, I would say, you know, which is fundamentally sort of the Western me, you know, versus the Russian we, if you put it that way.
Yeah, which is, I mean, we're seeing that all over the world right now, this same conversation going on. And, you know, listen, many of my mystic friends would say that history doesn't repeat, it simply rhymes. Mm. And that's what I felt reading this book. Turning the pages, I felt transported to the Silver Age, which felt seemingly eerily so similar to what's happening now. The ability to gleam information or insight of some of the great thinkers of that time is a fascinating study in how we can shape our future from our past, or how at least we can learn from the past, and we cannot forget
this
that.
I mean, this is it. I mean, there's a wonderful book called The Face of Glory by a fellow named William Anderson, who was a poet, but he also wrote about the Gothic cathedrals and The Green Man. He had a book called The Green Man. But he has this notion of what he calls the great memory. And it is sort of like, it basically is the culture, you know, the literature, the art, the music, the architecture, you know, the religion, all of this that's come down to us. And each time, you know, generation or crises or challenge that arises is not the same, but similar to. And, you know, our response to it is not the same, but we can, as you just said, can learn from in the past. And there's so many, and this is, Anderson comes up with lots of examples where, you know, parallels in sort of history, you know, centuries separating them, but kind of similar challenges and similar responses. But this is something that the Russians are supposed to, you know, supposed to have been very good at, by taking stuff from others or having it come to them and informing them, and then changing it around and making it some kind of uniquely their own. Mm. And one of the things that I say in the book is that, you know, at the end of it, I say it's pretty clear what, you know, Russia wanted to get from the West, in say in the form of Peter the Great or something like that. They wanted basically modernity. You know, they wanted to have, you know, logic and reason and all of that, and order, and you know, all of the virtues that have, you know, gone into creating, you know, our modern world, and pulling Russia out of the Middle Ages. But what did Russia have to give to the West? And I say it's something that the West had but didn't want. And the Russians picked up on it, and this is the whole kind of romantic, you know, sensibility, the romantic movement, and mostly in the form of this German philosopher that meets Schelling, who strangely enough has come into vogue. Again, I shouldn't say nobody reads, but there's an interest in him in the alternative world a lot, because he's very nature oriented, but he's trying to arrive at a kind of you know, compatible harmony between the human and the natural world. And I mean, to put it in a nutshell, he says nature is visible mind, and mind is invisible nature, and so not to subsume one in the other. But and I mean, he's, you know, one of these. Well, he's not as difficult as some of the other ones, but he is one of these very expansive, romantic, you know, sort of metaphysical, poetic thinkers. And he's around the same time as Hegel and all that. But he had a big impact on Russian philosophers before Marx and all that, which is, you know, that's the thing. I mean, I was talking to somebody last night in an interview, and the person kept saying, I just never thought of Russia as being spiritual. And I was saying, well, probably, I would suspect, is because you say Russia and you think communism. You know, you think Russia and you think Marx, you think the Soviet Union, and this is, you know, from the generation I came from, and, you know, one before, that's what it was. And, you know, it's one of these funny things that people are born after you. You can't imagine that it's actually like that, but, you know, some people are born after the fall, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and after all that, and they don't remember the Soviet Union, they don't remember any of that. So, you know, when they think Russia, they think Putin, and they think, I don't know, oligarchs and people getting assassinated or something like that. I don't mean to say that's all that Russia is about. But you know, Russia had this intense spirituality. That's why it was called Holy Russia.
Yeah.
It got that title after the Napoleonic Wars, when it saved Europe, saved all the monarchies in Europe, from the little corporal.
Well, we find ourselves right now in not a Siberian winter, but more of a viral winter. And it's the perfect time to dive back into the history and philosophies that have been there waiting to be rediscovered and re-looked upon. And Gary Lachman does a fantastic job in presenting these in a narrative way that keeps you turning the pages and keeps you invested in the personal stories behind this as well. Gary, what is the easiest way for people to find your work?
I guess it's on Amazon, you know, or just Google me. I guess that's it. You know, I have a blog. It's all one lowercase, garylachman.co.uk. You can leave a message for me there if you want on Twitter. So, I mean, I'm out in the world, you know, like others. But yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, I enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you so much for joining us, Gary. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Night Drift, presented by Euphemet. Thank you to our guest, Gary Lachman. For more of his work, find links in the show notes. And thank you as well to our sponsors, Spotify and Anchor. For everything Euphemet, including how you can subscribe to the show, links to our Patreon and social media, visit euphemet.com. Also there, you will find Euphemet merchandise. My cat just jumped up onto my table as I was saying this. Thank you, cat, for disturbing this outro. And thank you for listening. This is Jim Perry, and until next time, keep looking up.
Follow Euphemet on Spotify and subscribe on iTunes to receive new episodes of Night Drift automatically and gain access to all of our past episodes.